Log Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Psychic Teachers Book Club. I'm your host, Samantha Fay.
And I'm Deb Bowen.
And we're excited to have you here with us to talk about part two of Illusions by Richard Bach. We hope that you had a lovely weekend, and we hope that you can take a time out of your Monday morning to sit down and have a cup of tea with us as we talk about Illusions and the Reluctant Messiah.
I love this book, Samantha. I said this last week, and I will say it again. This is if I were on a deserted island, this is one of the books I would want with me. And this book changed my life when I read it initially.
Wow.
It really did. It gave me an entirely different perspective on the world. And that notion that I, too, am someone who can change the world and influence the world, which is one of the points of the book for me. I just love it. I just love it. So we talked last week about the plot, which is really a fairly thin disguise for the message. You know, the metaphor of flying and old antique biplanes, they're called, and giving rides to people out of cornfields and hay fields in the Midwest is the notion behind the book. However, Don Shimoda, who is the Messiah in the book, has come to meet Richard Bach in his plane. The two of them meet up in their airplanes, and Shimoda begins to teach him in a very gentle and sometimes humorous way about what it means for each of us to be our own Messiah, to be responsible for our place in the world and our brothers and sisters, and about what it means to evolve and become. And most of us are familiar with this quote. We may not realize that it came from this book. I just want to read this. The mark of your ignorance is the depth of your belief in injustice and tragedy. What the caterpillar calls the end of the world, the master calls a butterfly.
That is so beautiful.
I love it. I just love it. And think about it. We spend much of our lives cocooning and becoming. And then we break free and we have an aha moment and we have a realization and a shift in our psyche. And that happens more than once in our lives. For most people, it happens a lot. We just don't always conceptualize it as that.
Yeah. Can I talk about that a minute?
Sure, please.
I've had a lot of clients going through that. They're spiritual awakenings, and like you said, I do think there are several in our lifetime if we're lucky.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the symptoms of them, people don't recognize as spiritual awakenings, because while you're in that cocoon, you will feel dark. Sometimes you'll feel sad, disconnected, lonely, misunderstood. You'll question your place in the world. You'll question your place in your relationships. You might see some relationships end during that spiritual awakening. You might feel really tired at some times. You might feel really wired and excited and awake at other times. It's a very fluctuating energy during that process.
You may feel angry.
Yes, angry, sad, happy. The key when you're going through a spiritual awakening, the way I think to best get through it is to feel your feelings through it. You know, don't try to hide anything or repress anything or shove anything under the rug. Just let all the feelings come up and be what they are. Don't judge them. Don't question them. Don't push them away. Write about them. Write about what's going on inside of your head during this process. And, you know, find like-minded friends that you can share this with, and know that at the end of this spiritual awakening, you will emerge as the butterfly.
You really do. You know, I think that cocooning time is often the time in which our clients reach out to us.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you who might be new to Psychic Teachers Book Club, Samantha and I are both psychics, and we do readings for people around the world, and we also offer spiritual coaching. And so often it is that almost cataclysmic feeling that bring people to us in hopes of some kind of support and clarity.
You know, there's a quote from this book that I really love. He says, "You are never given a wish without being given the power to make it true.
You may have to work for it, however."
Mm-hmm.
I don't even have the book open.
You just know that's the next line. That is the next line.
I know it.
But I love that for two reasons. One, it reminds us that wishes are possible. But two, it also reminds us that we have to make them come true.
That we have some responsibility,
mm-hmm.
you know. And for me, that means don't let life happen to you.
Yes.
You happen to life.
Yeah.
And often we want, we and sometimes our clients want answers that will just make everything all better. And I think that's being human.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all do. We want somebody, something to shift things for us. I love the serenity prayer that's a part of the AA, the 12-step model.
Yeah.
I love that prayer. You know, God grant me the serenity too. But I love another version of that prayer so much. And it was actually a gift to me from a minister's wife in the Unity movement. And the prayer says, God grant me the serenity to accept the people I cannot change, the wisdom to change the person I no, the courage to change the person I can. I'm blowing it. Let me start again. God grant me the serenity to accept the people I cannot change, the courage to change the person I can, and the wisdom to know that person is me.
Yes.
I love that.
I do too, because it's really important to remember that. We are the only people we can change.
Right.
You know, and there's always change. He has another quote where he says something like, here is a test to find whether your mission on Earth is finished.
If you're alive,
it isn't.
That's right.
And
I did just open to that page. How funny.
Oh, that is weird. I had a client, if I could just tell a quick story. She was 95 years old, and she would come to me every 3 months, and her only question was, when am I going to die?
Yes, that same client came to see me.
She just couldn't wait to die. And at first I was like, oh, well, you have so much to live for. But when she kept coming back, I thought, all right, I need to find out, like, why, she is still here. Like, what's her purpose? Why is she holding on? Why aren't they letting her pass? And so I said to her, they're just showing me your son and something that happened when he was 51. And she said, oh, that was nothing. And I said, well, I don't know. I mean, when I ask, why are you still here, that's what they're showing me. And she said, well, he tried to kill himself, but he always liked the attention.
Oh, I remember this.
And I said, well, I think you need to ask him for forgiveness. And we won't go into the whole thing, but she could not face that concept that she would have to ask her child for forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why she was still here.
Where she still needed to work on that.
That's right. So even if you're 95, you're still serving a purpose, and that purpose might just be seeing that the only person you can change is you.
And you know, yes, and that is and this actually happens very early in the book, where Don and Richard, Don the Messiah and Richard, are discussing why we have a purpose in life and what that's all about, and. Don had been quite well known as a Messiah and just quit, walked off the job as a Messiah. And Richard saying, I didn't think you could do that. And Don said, oh, yeah, it's free will. You can do it. You can do anything you want to do. And Richard says something to him to the effect of, well, you know, if you need other people's validation for you to be who you are, then you're missing the point. And Don looks at him and says, oh, my God, that's the lesson I've come to learn in this lifetime. And so then he really starts pushing to teach Richard everything he can. And Richard says, well, and he says this facetiously, well, I might get all of this in a few weeks. And Don says, boy, I hope it won't take that long. and indeed, Don is killed in what to us would appear to be a terrible way. He is shot, and as he is dying and he and Richard are talking, Richard says to Don, who was that guy who shot you and ran off? He must be a terrible person. And Don says, no, he was a friend. And that sentence was the sentence that led me to begin to realize that we all really do come into each other's lives for a purpose,
mm-hmm.
and that sometimes the greatest lessons in our lives overcome under the most adverse circumstances and from the most obstreperous people, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
That's a really hard lesson to grasp.
It is.
I just think that that's a really hard lesson for people to grasp. I think for me, I can understand that intellectually, but sometimes living it out is really difficult.
Well, you know, I think about a boss I had one time
mm-hmm.
who was really, really, really difficult to work with. And I spent a lot of time asking why I had that situation in my life. What was the lesson I was supposed to learn here? And the lesson was to give me freedom to make a shift in my life, because
right.
because it was the situation was so unbearable that I finally was able to shift and move and do something different, and so in many ways it was my relationship with that person was a gift.
And I totally get that, but then there's like I've said before on our other podcast, my husband was shot in the line of duty and by the skin of his teeth survived, and. When you say that, like for me to think about the man, the criminal who shot my husband, who was a police officer for almost 20 years, trying so hard to protect this city, for me to look at that man and say he's a friend, it's really hard.
Yeah.
Especially knowing he was a rapist and just not a nice person. It's really hard.
But, I know it is. And as I recall, because of the circumstances in that situation, the perpetrator in your husband's situation was shot, right?
Correct.
And he was killed.
Correct.
And so the gift may have been to have gotten him finished with this lifetime to move on and learn some other lessons.
Right. But it's the same as with your boss, though, because if you said to me, like, what have you learned from your husband's shooting, the lessons are innumerable. I've learned strength and power and resilience and courage. Beautiful lessons have come out of it.
Right.
But there's always a little four-year-old in me that goes, couldn't I have learned it another way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's very human that we think, gosh, do the lessons always have to be hard?
Yeah.
Darn it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He says, the bond that links your true family is not one of blood.
Mm-hmm.
And I really do like that concept. He said it's a bond of respect and joy in each other's life. Rarely do members of one family grow up under the same roof.
And that's that passage in the book taught me about relationships and the concept of family outside of biological on this plane, but it also opened the door for me to understand soul groups as we move from one lifetime to another.
Do you want to talk about that a little bit? Because that might be a new concept for some people.
It may be. It's the idea that we have a group of people, sometimes biological relatives, sometimes relatives by emotional and connection, with whom we travel from one lifetime to another, and we agree to play parts in each other's life movies to help each other learn lessons. And that's what happens in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid story in this book.
Mm-hmm.
Richard asks a question, and Don's answer is, let's go see a movie. And they go see Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which is a great movie. People love that movie. But the lesson wasn't about the movie itself. It was the idea that each of us, our lives are a movie. And that before we come into each lifetime, we have written the script, we have designed the set, figured out places where it's going to take place, we have cast the characters, we've done all of the work that needs to be done to create this lifetime that is a movie. And we each work to each character in the movie has a point and a purpose to help each other learn life lessons that we come into each lifetime to learn.
I think that is the best way to look at life. I remember when I went to see you in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Uh-huh.
That was such a wonderful production, and you all did such an amazing job that I was swept away in the dramatic scenes. And so when the lights came on and everyone came out and the mean true killer came on stage, I wanted to like growl or throw apples at him like they did in the olden days. You know, and then I saw you all hugging him and I realized like I had to like be snapped back into reality, you know, like, oh, he's a nice guy, he's an actor, he's playing a part.
Right.
And it, I have to be reminded of that too. Like, you know, maybe the man who shot my husband, maybe his soul is super kind and nice and he was playing a part. Maybe not. We don't know. But I think it's lovely to consider that.
I do too. I do too. And I think it, for me, even with the pain of relationships that happen, it allows me to stop and say, this is a tortured soul.
Mm, yes.
And so that idea that you were talking about our 95-year-old client a few minutes ago, the idea of forgiveness becomes easier.
Yeah. Yep. Forgive them, they know not what they do.
That's right. That's right. We're at the halfway mark, Samantha. Let's tell everybody who we are.
Okay.
We are the Psychic Teachers. I am Deb Bowen.
I'm Samantha Faye.
And we love doing this podcast. We are avid readers. I can't tell you how much Samantha and I read. We also do a podcast on Sunday nights live at 9 o'clock Eastern Time on Blog Talk, which you can also download 5 years worth of podcast from iTunes. We do psychic readings. We do spiritual coachings. We have a line of self-help products. And our websites are www.SamanthaFay, and that's spelled F-E-Y, SamanthaFay.com, and DebBowen.com. And I'll put both of those in our chat room for us.
And it's two B's, right?
It is. It's Deb Bowen.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay.
Right. So there we go.
All right.
Okay. You talk while I type.
Okay, I will do that. So I like this idea that our true family isn't necessarily the one that we're born into, because I do feel that very often the family that we're born into is the family that we have lessons to learn from and gifts to teach. And that our true family will come into our life at certain times of our life. So you might recognize a member of your soul group in your best friend, in a mentor, in a spouse or a partner or a child. But you might they might just come in the guise of friends.
Right.
I bet, Deb, with all your years of teaching, I bet you've met a couple of students who might be part of your soul group.
Oh, more than a couple.
Yeah.
More than a couple. And some of my students have been my very best teachers. For example, and you certainly know my friend Raven,
mm-hmm.
who was my student many, many years ago and who led me on my path to my connection with my Lakota friends. My friend Sarah, who is more psychic than me. There are tons of them. And I think about my wonderful Granny Jean. And if you're a new listener to Psychic Teachers, you may not know about Granny Jean. She is 88, and she and I have been friends for almost 45 years. And I walked into her house the very first time, and I knew I'd come home. And I've never left. We've always been friends. We've never had a crossword in all those years.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's saying something, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I just knew I had come home. And she and I and her husband have done lots of past life regression work together, and we know about many lifetimes that we've had together.
That's so wonderful.
Mm-hmm. It is.
He says, remember where you came from, remember where you're going, and why you created the mess you got yourself into.
And we so often forget or do not realize that we create these messes in our lives.
I know, and I want to talk about that for a quick minute if possible.
Okay,
because
sure.
Some of the one of the issues I have with a lot of the metaphysical, spiritual, New Age thought is it tends to... Well, sometimes you can perceive that its lessons tend to put blame on the individual.
Mm,
you know what I mean? Like
I do.
If you have rheumatoid arthritis, it's because you're stuffing emotions down. If you have asthma, it's because, you know, you're suffocating yourself and not let... You know, there's just this this message sometimes of self-blame. I was listening to Coast to Coast, and they had on a bona fide doctor, you know, like a MD, and he's all into this, you know, holistic supplement stuff. And you know what he said? He said cancer is never genetic. It's always caused by the choices of the person who gets it.
Interesting.
And I just thought, how dare you? When there are, you know, I met a nurse just a couple of weeks ago, and her mother is one of five daughters, and her grandmother and all four of her aunts have died of breast cancer. Like, I don't know how you can say that it's not genetic. So anyway, that's just something I always grapple with myself. Like, do we cause every mess, or is it sometimes we're just caught up in the tornado of genetics or bad timing? How can we know?
I don't know that we do know. I don't know that we'll ever know that until we get to the other side and get to ask that question. There's another question for my notebook I want to carry
or like,
with me across
say,
the veil.
Let's say that you're married. And let's say that your husband has created a ton of chaos. Like, I don't know, let's say he embezzled money from his company and he's going off to jail. Could you, so, and then you have to deal with, you know, the pieces. Would that be a mess you created?
I don't know about that, but it's that you agreed to, according to the concept in this book.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't that you so much created this mess, but you agreed to play a part in someone else's mess.
Got it. Okay. See, and I think that's important for people to hear, that not every mess is your creation, but maybe every dramatic mess in your life you did agree to be a part of.
Mm-hmm. You did.
Yeah.
You did. And you know...
Because there's that... You've seen the movie The Secret...
Of course.
Remember that guy who's like, I'm going to be a little bit in your face right now. Every bad thing that's ever happened to you, you created.
Yeah.
And I just kind of thought, really? I don't know. I thought about my friend who was just like walking home late from work one night at 10:30 and got mugged. Like, did she really create that? I don't know.
Well, you know, I don't know either. And then I guess the other piece of this is that... in the big scheme of things, I wonder sometimes how much the is, as it is called in the book, you know, that cosmic God or however you want to call it, pays attention to that, sometimes what might be considered small stuff.
Mm. That's really important. Well, see, that's why I like my view of the other side. Which is like a big corporation where there's like, you know, the CEO, and then he or she farms everything out. It's all delegated out, down and down and down and down, so that our spirit guides and our guardian angels are aware of the minutia of our life.
Maybe so. And here's Bach's answer to your question.
Okay.
Every person, all the events of your life are there because you have drawn them there. What you choose to do with them is up to you. That we always have free will. We always have choices as to how we deal with given messes, as you call them, or situations.
But do you know what I'm saying? Like take, you know, that movie script that you were reading yesterday. I mean, what if a woman was raped? I mean, how can we say to her, you drew that into your life? I don't think that's fair. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do. I do, and those are hard questions, and I don't have an answer for them.
Yeah,
I don't.
I don't think any of us can, and I think that's, I'm just, you know, I think it's important for everyone to know that just because, well, I won't speak for you, Deb, but just because I call myself a psychic teacher does not mean I have nearly a percentage of any of the answers. I just like to. Explore and question all of these things, you know, because they are so beyond our grasp.
Right. Well, they are behind our grasp. And I think, you know, the first time I read this book, I got to a point in the book where, and it's at the very end, there's an epilogue, and these words ran through me and just, it was like diving into ice-cold water.
Wow.
Everything in this book may be wrong.
Wow.
That's the last sentence in the book.
And that is very powerful. And
it
it's very true.
And it is very true. It really is about, it really is about, we don't know, but it's always important to at least entertain a notion. What was it? How did Aristotle say that? It is the mark of an educated man to be able to entertain an idea without accepting
two opposing
it.
Ideas.
Yeah, right.
I'll try to find the exact quote so we don't misquote Aristotle, because that would not be good.
That would not be good. And I can also quote a similar thing from Merlin the Magician in Mary Stuart's book, The Hollow Hills, and I can quote this verbatim. Never turn from knowing, no matter how the knowing comes.
That's so nice. Mm-hmm. It is the mark of an educated mind to be able to entertain a thought without accepting it.
There you go. To just play with it, to just be curious.
Yeah, I think that's really important.
Uh-huh.
Okay, now tell me this, because this is something else I wonder when I read this book. Why is he called the Reluctant Messiah?
Because he really didn't want to do the job. And you know, Don had been a messiah, you know, with the big crowds and,
mm-hmm,
and the miracle,
mm-hmm,
kind of stuff. You know, again, just remember this is fiction. And he walked away. And Richard doesn't really want this job either. He doesn't want the big crowds. These guys are introverts. They enjoy flying their planes across the grasslands of the heartland of America. They don't want this job of being a messiah and being a teacher. And they have this conversation repeatedly, both of them, about the, being drawn to do this work, believing they're supposed to do it, and really not wanting to do it at all. And so Richard says, well, I'm just not going to go there. I'm not going to go to the crowds and do all this. And Don says, well, you could maybe write a book. You could write it down. And Richard says, do you know how hard it is to write a book? I swore I'd never write another one. And, of course, he does. And Illusions is that book, his story of his relationship with Don.
Doesn't he say in there that, in a way, we're all reluctant messiahs?
Yes. Yes, and that goes right back to a sentence from Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything I can do, you can do, and more.
I don't know why that song just popped into my head. Anything I can do, you can do better.
Well, you know, Jesus sort of said that.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, I like the idea that it's a reluctant messiah, because I do think many of the things we're called to do in our lifetime aren't things that consciously we would, you know, volunteer to do.
Right.
And I think that can be really hard. I remember that reading I did years ago where the mother showed me that she incarnated as a severely mentally ill woman, strictly to teach her children independence and courage and fearlessness.
Right.
And I think how brave it was for her to do that, and how hard it must have been to live a lifetime as a mentally ill person. But we do that.
We
make those choices.
We do. Samantha, we're out of time. Thank you all so very much for being with us. We hope that you have enjoyed entertaining the notion of things that might not be true for you at this moment. Next week I'm going to be alone, and I'm going to talk about a variety of books that impacted my journey, and some classics in the self-help and metaphysical world. So please tune in for us next week.
Thank you so much, everyone. Have a great week.
Bye-bye, everybody.